Our subject today is the book of Job, but we're actually going to start in Ezekiel. You can turn with me to Ezekiel, chapter 14, take a little bit of a detour. When I was a teenager, I was at some, youth rally or something, and they were having a Bible trivia quiz. And someone asked the question, who were the three greatest men in the Old Testament? And I thought that sounded like a trick question. But it couldn't be a right answer to that question. People would have different opinions about that question. I didn't think it was a fair question. But the man who was asking had in mind Ezekiel chapter 14. If you look with me at verse 12, thus the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, if a country sins against me by committing unfaithfulness, and I stretch out my hand against it, destroy its supply of bread, send famine against it, cut off from it man and beast. Even though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in the midst of it, by their own righteousness, they could not deliver, they could only deliver themselves, declares the Lord. And this man said, there's the answer. Those are the three greatest men in the Old Testament. Noah, and Daniel, and Job. So we're talking about the story of Job today. I don't want to start by asking you to think about why did he make this list? Why do you think Ezekiel, out of all of the men in the Old Testament, I mean, why not Abraham? Why not David? Why not a lot of other people we could pick? Why do you think Ezekiel picked out Noah and Daniel and Job?
Job, because God said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job?
Okay, yeah, because God pointed to Job. And what is specifically about Job?
He had integrity.
He was righteous. He had integrity. That's what Ezekiel's saying here. He's pointing out these three men. There's something about their righteousness. That said of Noah, Noah was righteous and blameless in his generation. Job was blameless and upright. Daniel was the man they tried to find a reason to accuse him, and they couldn't find any flaw. These were three righteous men. So I think I was partly right, because the verse doesn't say they were the greatest men, but it does say they were three righteous men. I think there's more. That's one thing these three men have in common. They're commended for their righteousness, for their integrity. What else do these three men have in common? I had the benefit of a whole week to think about
They had no control over the circumstance that happened.
They found themselves in dramatic trouble. All three of these men had their whole world turned upside down. You think about Noah. We tend to emphasize how he's delivered from the flood. Do you know how that totally changed his life? How everything he knew, his whole life just changed overnight when God said, here's what you're going to spend the next 100 years doing. You're going to build a big boat. Because your whole world is going to be wiped out and you are going to start over. Noah was a man whose life was completely turned upside down by the flood. Daniel was a man who was taken into captivity, and his whole world was turned upside down. And Job's whole world, in a day, was turned upside down. And what's interesting to me about that was, in all three cases, it was absolutely not their fault. Isn't that true?
Yes.
That's why the Bible points out their righteousness. Was the flood Noah's fault? Did he bring that on himself? Was the captivity Daniel's fault? Did he personally bring that on himself? When you look at people like Abraham and David, they had some real troubles in their life. And some of that trouble was their own fault. Some of that trouble was the consequence of their sin. But that is not the case of Noah. That is not the case of Daniel. That is not the case of Job. I think that's why Ezekiel picks out these three people, because he says, this country, this nation is going through captivity. It's going through a time of crisis. The nation's being destroyed. Even though Noah was a righteous man, he couldn't stop the flood from coming. His righteousness wasn't enough. The flood's going to come. Daniel couldn't stop the captivity from coming, even though he was a righteous teenager, apparently. That wasn't enough to stop the captivity from coming. And Job's righteousness was not something that stopped this tragedy from coming into his life. So I think that's a good way to introduce us to the book of Job. Let's go back to the book of Job now and ask a very important question. When did Job live? And we don't know. There are no time references in the book at all. But most people assume that he is pre-Abraham, that he is way back early in history. And I want to mention briefly four reasons for that. The first one is in the very last verse of Job. The next to the last verse. Verse 16, Job 42:16. After this, after what? After his recovery, after his restoration, Job lived 140 years. And I think that means 140 years more. After he had 10 grown adult children. It appears that Job lived at least a couple hundred years. That was normal before Abraham. Noah lived 960 years. Shem lives 900 years. Arphaxad lives 500 years. By the time you get to Peleg, it's 239 years. Terah lives 200 years. Abraham lives 175 years. To find people living 200 or 300 years, you have to go back before Abraham. So that's a big clue that Job lived a long time ago. Another thing that's really interesting, in the first chapter, Job is acting as a priest for his family. It says in Job 1:5 that Job rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings. Job offered burnt offerings for his kids. He's acting like priest for his family. That's obviously before the law. That's before Moses. That's the kind of situation with Abraham and his family. Job seems to be the priest for his family. And of course, there's no reference to the Pentateuch. There's no reference to the patriarchs. There's nothing Jewish about this book at all. It's hard to believe that you could go through 42 chapters and never mention the Pentateuch, if it already existed, if it had already been written. And they then point out that his wealth is measured in livestock. When we tell how rich Job is, it's not how much gold and silver he has, it's how many animals he has. And then I can't speak to this, but the people that know Hebrew say the style of the book seems very old. The style of the writing is very unusual. It just reads like an ancient story. So when did Job live? We don't know, but most people put him between Noah and Abraham. In that little gap in the Bible where we actually know very little. What other Bible stories do you know between Noah and Abraham? There's about 500 years, though. Who do you know that lived in those 500 years? We know Noah's kids, Ham, Shem, Japheth. We know Abraham's dad, Terah. Do you know any other names? It's kind of like a big blank spot in the Bible history. The Bible tells us very little about what happened between Noah and Abraham. Now, one reason might be there aren't very many people alive. It is just Noah and his family. That's the whole story when you come out of the ark. But it's possible that Job fits that gap, that Job is one of the rare characters somewhere between Noah and Abraham. I think that's true. Now, when was the book actually written down? Nobody thinks this was written by Job. It doesn't read like an autobiography. Job is not saying, this is what I did, this is what happened to me. It's like there's a narrator. Someone is writing down the story. Someone is telling us the story of Job. We don't actually know. There is no clue in the book about who wrote it, when it was actually written down. And that shouldn't really bother you, because when was Genesis written down? The things being described are happening way back at creation. But we think that Moses wrote them down. Genesis was written down later, I think. Job apparently was written down. Somebody sat down and wrote Job's story for us to read. We actually don't know who that was. It would be kind of unusual if Job's autobiography included his own death. It's unlikely that he wrote about his own death in his autobiography. So we don't know. What's the genre of this book? What kind of literature is the Book of Job? Well, when you start reading, you think it's going to be historical. It sounds like a story. The book opens with a story, a narrative, but that only lasts two chapters. And then in chapter 3, it's not really a story anymore. Starting in chapter 3, it's a debate. It's a discussion. It's a deep philosophical discussion. And parts of it read like poetry. The language experts say it's very unusual grammar. He uses lots of big words, lots of old-fashioned words. It's an unusual vocabulary. Most of the book doesn't read like history. It's not like the story of Ruth. It's not like the story of Judges. And that's why it's where it is in our Bible. Because it's considered a poetry book. It's considered a wisdom book. It's in the package with Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes as an unusual kind of a book. So here's a very simple outline. There is the tragic story in the first two chapters. Then there is this long discussion, debate for 35 chapters. And then God shows up. And you expect that God's going to have answers. God doesn't have any answers for Job. You know what God has for Job? Questions. There is a, four-chapter quiz. And do you know what most of those questions are about? Most of those questions are science questions. Job is one of my favorite books in the Bible, and this is one reason why. Because the book of Job is full of references to science. I teach a class called Essential Science. It's a class that's required that most of the students don't want to take. It's a challenging class to teach because I know most of the students in the room actually don't want to be there. They don't like science. And when people ask me, why do we have to take essential science? There are several good answers to that question. And one of my favorite kind of snarky answers is, go read the book of Job. Because when God shows up in Job's life, he gives him a four-chapter science quiz. That's God's answer to Job. And then there's a conclusion. So that's the story. There's the brief story, the long debate, the quiz, and then a conclusion. That's the book of Job. But right in the middle of the book of Job, chapter 28, this is where we're going to spend some time, is an unusual chapter that doesn't really fit the pattern. This is right in the middle of the debate. The debate is not over yet. But Job chapter 28 doesn't fit. It's not an argument. It's not about the thing they've been arguing about for the last 20 chapters. It's an unusual chapter. In fact, it's actually obviously in the style of a poem. Look with me quickly at verse 12. Job chapter 28, verse 12. Where can wisdom be found? Where is the place of understanding? Look at verse 20. Where then does wisdom come from? Where is the place of understanding? That's like a little refrain. The first 11 verses are like a verse of a poem, and then we come to that refrain. Where can you find wisdom? And then we have another little stanza of the poem, and then we have this refrain. Where can you find wisdom? And then look at verse 28. It's not the question now, it's the answer. To man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord. That is wisdom. So this reads like a poem. Where is wisdom? Where does wisdom come from? Well, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. This chapter is a poem about wisdom. It actually sounds a lot like Proverbs. That's what I'm saying. This is why people categorize this as a wisdom book. It's partly about Job and his story and his suffering. But it's also a book about wisdom. What is in chapter 28? This is really fascinating. If you just run your eyes down the first 11 verses, and try to figure out the big idea. What is this about? There's a mine for silver. There's a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust. Copper is smelted from the rock. Man, he goes down in the gloom and the deep shadows. He sinks a shaft. He hangs. He swings down in his mind. The earth, from it comes food up on the surface. Verse 5, underneath, it is turned up as fire. The rocks are the sources of sapphires. What is he talking about here? He's describing mining. He's describing what humans do when they go out and they dig in the ground and they make these tunnels and they have to take lights and they discover gold and iron and copper and precious gems. We've got 11 verses that are just a description of how people search for treasures in the depths of the earth. And then he says, but what about wisdom? Where are you going to dig for that? Where are you going to mine that? Is all of our human ingenuity and mining, is that going to lead us somehow to wisdom? Okay, then the next stanza, verse 13. This isn't about how we mine stuff. It's about the value of what we find. Man doesn't know its value. Verse 15, pure gold cannot be given in exchange for wisdom, nor can silver be weighed as its price, wisdom's price. You want to compare it to gold, to onyx, to sapphire, coral, crystal, pearls, topaz. He's going through all of these natural resources that are very valuable. Say, look how people dig for gold and silver and precious jewels. Think how valuable those are in our culture. Now, what about wisdom? This does sound like Proverbs, right? Wisdom is way more valuable than any of that stuff. So verse 20, where does wisdom come from? Where is the place of understanding? It's hidden from the eyes of all living. Everybody seems to want wisdom. It's like nobody knows where to find it. It's hidden, verse 21, from the eyes of all living. Verse 22, what about the dead? Abaddon and death. What if you could conjure up people from the grave, people who are already dead? Can they give me the secret of wisdom? No, they say, well, we've heard of a report of it. God knows the way. God knows his place. He weighed the wind. He measured out the waters. He saw it. He declared it. He established it. To man, he said, end of the story, final answer, the fear of the Lord. That's where you're going to find this.
Sounds like Solomon.
It does sound like Solomon. Some people think that Solomon might be the one who wrote down the book of Job. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't see anything that really clearly says yes or no, but this is obviously a wisdom book. And this chapter ought to remind you a lot of Proverbs chapter 2, Proverbs chapter 3, this thing about search for wisdom, search for it as gold. This is a poem about wisdom. Now here's something that's kind of funny. This week I looked up Job on Wikipedia. Wikipedia is not a recommended Bible study. You're rarely going to hear me quote Wikipedia in Sunday school. Most of what's there is pretty liberal. It's actually not a bad place to start. If you want to know what do liberals say about some Bible topic, go see what's in Wikipedia, because it's probably a fairly liberal interpretation. But for various reasons, I was looking at the Wikipedia entry on Job, and they singled out this chapter. And they pointed out that this chapter is about wisdom. And Wikipedia said, this is the conclusion of the poem. Wisdom is hidden from men. They said, that's the conclusion of the poem. Wisdom is hidden. Like, you're not going to find wisdom. And I read that and I laughed. I said, that's not the conclusion of this poem. Look at the last line. What is the conclusion? The fear of the Lord. That is wisdom. Whoever wrote that Wikipedia page, I can tell them where to find wisdom. I thought that was kind of funny. Here's the conclusion. Some didn't want to admit that, I guess. Okay, so that's chapter 28. Now, here's the interesting thing. When we write newspaper article, a book, an essay, We kind of have two styles of writing in English, where you either put the most important thing at the front, or you put the most important thing at the end. If you're writing journalism, like a magazine article, a newspaper story, famously they say, put the most important thing right at the front. They call it the lead. You heard that phrase, don't bury the lead? In a newspaper, you want to get to the main point right at the start. I think it's just in... People may not read all the way to the end. Not in the newspaper. When you write like a persuasive essay, you do the opposite. You build up all your arguments, and then the big conclusion comes right at the end. But there is a style of Hebrew writing, and this seems to happen several times in the Bible, where you put the most important thing right in the middle. It's like an hourglass structure. Some people call it an X structure, where there's a beginning and there's an ending, and it all focuses on the big point is actually right in the middle. And some people think that's the way the book of Job was written. That the main point of the book of Job is actually chapter 28. It's right in the middle. This poem about wisdom, some people would say, is actually the pinnacle of the book. Now, people say the theme of the book of Job is suffering. That's certainly true. Job's suffering is a major theme of this book. But you can argue that wisdom is an equally important theme. We only looked at chapter 28, but wisdom is actually mentioned 19 times in the book of Job. There are 19 references to wisdom. And so I would suggest that the theme of the book of Job is maybe how to respond wisely to suffering. It's not just about suffering, you know, get some sympathy out of this book, but it's how to respond wisely to suffering is maybe the theme of the book. So let's jump in now to the central problem, the question. The thing that the book of Job is, in a sense, all about. It's captured in a famous title of a famous book from back in the 70s. Why do bad things happen to good people? People have suggested that the whole book of Job is an attempt to answer that question. Why do bad things happen to good people? The problem of evil. Because they do, right? Bad things happen to good people, and that's hard to understand. And let me show you this line of thought actually from the book of Job. Could you go to chapter 10? And you're going to hear that question from the mouth of Job. Job chapter 10, verse 1. I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. Is Job suffering? Yeah, he is. Job is suffering. Now look at verse 2. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why. That is the one word question that's in your mind when life gets really turned upside down. Why is this happening? God, I want to know why? Because, verse 7, according to your knowledge, you know, God, that I am indeed not guilty. Not guilty of all those horrible things that his friends have been accusing him of. His friends are saying, your life is turned upside down because you must be a horrible sinner. There's some secret sin in your life, and God is judging you for your sin. And Job says, God knows, God is my witness. That is not true. And given that that's not true, verse 2, I want to know why. See, Job is saying exactly what I'm suggesting. Job is saying, I want to know why these bad things have happened to me because I'm one of the good guys. Why do bad things happen to good people? Now, Job's friends have an answer. I just referred to that. Look at chapter 4. in verse 7, and this is Eliphaz. Verse 7, remember now, whoever perished being innocent? Where were the upright destroyed? According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity, those who sow trouble, they harvest it. By the breath of God, they perish. Do you understand what he's saying? This is how life works. If you're righteous, God takes care of you. It's the guilty, the wicked, who harvest trouble. All of Job's friends agree. Zophar says, you know what? I bet God is punishing you less than you deserve. That's what Zophar says. You think your life is messed up now? Job, you must have sinned bad. You must have done something really, really horrible for this to happen to you. That's what Job's friends think. Now, we have to admit that they have a point. Romans 3:10, there is none righteous. No, not one. Right? Pastor Minnick has preached about this topic, and he said, when you ask the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Part of the answer is there aren't any good people. There aren't any truly good people. Do you really want to go to God and say, give me what I deserve? I demand what I deserve. We would all be in trouble if we did that, right? There's a point to be made that everybody's a sinner. Nobody's righteous. Job cannot be saying, Job cannot mean. Surely Job doesn't think that he's perfect, that he's sinless. That's not what's going on. And Job knows that, and that's not at all what he means. Look at chapter 9 and verse 2.
Bill, there's also the point in about the Lord's table where if you don't take it in the right way with God, there's some judgment there.
God definitely judges people for their sin, right? Yeah. There's some truth to what Eliphaz is saying. God does judge people for their sin. Some people are more righteous than others. And that's where Job is going in chapter 9 and verse 2. His friends have been beating on him that he must be a sinner. And Job answers, Job 9:1, I know, in truth, I know that this is so. And what he's talking about is the fact that everybody's a sinner. Job is not claiming sinless perfection. He says, yeah, I know, nobody's perfect, everybody sins, everybody deserves judgment from God. But look at the end of verse 2. I know that's true, but how can a man, I would read, how can any man be in the right before God? Here's the problem. If everybody is a sinner, if God judges sinners, then why isn't everybody in the world judged? Why isn't everybody in the world suffering? Yeah, I'm a sinner, and so is everybody else in the world. So if you're saying my life is messed up because of my sin, then why isn't everybody's life messed up because of their sin? There's something about this that doesn't quite add up.
Or the corollary, why can't bad guys do all these good things?
Sure. And Job's going to talk about that. Look at chapter 12 and verse 6. Job is saying the problem is deeper than you recognize. It's not just why do bad things happen to good people. It's this. Job 12:6. The tents of the destroyers, wicked, evil, notorious sinners. Those people, they're doing what? The tents of the destroyers, they are prospering. And there are people that provoke God. You know somebody like that? They don't just ignore God. They don't just disobey God. They provoke God. They defy God openly to his face. You ever known anybody like that? They provoke God. What's their life like? Sometimes they are secure. Destroyers are prospering. People that provoke God, their lives are secure. Whom God brings into their power. It almost seems like God is blessing them. How did they get to be so
rich? How did they get to be so powerful? Why are they prospering so well?
Job is saying, you know what? It almost looks to me like God is blessing them. God put them in that position of power. They didn't get there without God, right? See, the problem is not just why do bad things happen to good people. The problem is bad things happen to good people when at the same time good things are happening to bad people. That's what really irks us. If everybody's suffering, okay, we can suffer in our misery together. But how do you handle it when you're the one godly person in your workplace and life is really hard, and your coworkers, you don't have a blink of a fear of God in their minds, and everything's going smooth, and they don't have all the problems you do, they don't seem to be in trouble, God doesn't seem to be judging them. It's not just why do bad things happen to good people. Why do bad things happen to good people when at the same time good things are happening to bad people? Right? You know, I'm really sorry that we have to quit early because I only have 3 minutes to try to answer that question for you. And I'm obviously not going to answer the question for you today. That is a big question without a simple one-sentence answer. But the one thing I want to point you to is what Job says next. Job chapter 12, verse 6, he just said, these wicked people are prospering. Verse 7, so where might you go for an answer? Ask now the beasts, and let them teach you, and the birds of the heavens, let them teach you. Speak to the earth, let it teach you. Let the fish of the sea declare unto you. I think, are you kidding, Job? What kind of an answer is that? Go ask who? Go ask the fish, go ask the birds, what in the world are they going to tell me? Well, verse 9, among all these things in nature, isn't it obvious? Doesn't everybody know that what? That the hand of the Lord hath done this. Job is saying, if you would go look at nature, you could take some encouragement that God is actually in control. God is way wiser than you. That's the point of the science quiz. God is way stronger than you. That's the point of the science discussion. And God is still in control. If I could say it backwards, why is Job's life messed up? Is it possible because either God is not aware of what's going on, or God doesn't care, or God can't help? And that's what the famous book said. Why do bad things happen to good people? That was a liberal book. And the author's conclusion is there are only two explanations. Either God doesn't care, or God does care, but he can't help. It's a pretty discouraging conclusion. Job says, no. I am confident, in part based on my study of nature, that God is absolutely wise enough and powerful enough to handle whatever's going on in my life. And God is absolutely in control. I may not understand it. I may not like it. Maybe I can't explain it. But God's in control. This is what Ken Casillas wrote in the lesson. Job's experience challenges us to conclude, I don't need to know why. I just need to know God. And I thought that was a really good summary. I don't need to know why. I just need to know God. And we're out of time. You've got 42 chapters to try to think through this and digest it and understand it. But that's, to me, the big story of the book of Job. How do you respond wisely in one of these totally mixed up life situations? Well, what's the beginning of wisdom? It's the fear of the Lord. You've got to go to God. You've got to say like Job does at the end of this book, I'm just going to trust God. He says, even if I die, right? If the result of this is my death, I don't understand why the plan of God would lead to my dying. But if that's where this is headed, I'm okay with that. I'm going to come out at the end as gold. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you gave us this book. Help us to learn from it. I'm sure many people in this room are going through various kinds of suffering and trials.
And none of us probably have experienced things as bad as Job. But he did, in the end, come forth as gold. Help us to respond wisely. Help us to run to you. Help us to put our confidence in you, even when it is hard to understand. In Jesus' name, amen.